Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Now it's my turn at 10:09. Good morning. This is John Williams. You're listening to WGN. You hear me weekdays from 9 a.m. until 12 noon. That's my new slot, Monday through Friday. And on Saturdays, 10 to noon has been our home for quite a while now, but we're going to move this little clam bake of ours to 1 o'clock in the afternoon until 3 on Saturdays. Listen for some version of this with me then. So it's been a pleasure talking to you these days at this time. Let's go ahead and do our little show. By the way, James, you said in your newscast just a moment ago that, who was that? Some specialist was saying that rather than having vague resolutions for the new year or those that are too ambitious, we should come up with micro resolutions for more practical goals, huh?
That's right. She's saying, it's how we eat, it's how we rest, how we move. So quick, manageable things, not like saying I'm going to lose weight, but give a more specific, I'm going to lose 5 pounds this month, some smaller steps.
Or don't say I'm going to run a marathon. If you're not a marathon runner, say I'm going to run 3 times a week.
Exactly.
At least you can get your head around that. Sometimes a resolution is something you do. Sometimes it's something you abstain from. I was thinking of all of the things that I want to do. For instance, one of them would be I have a closet in which all of my clothes and shoes and personal effects live. And it overwhelms me constantly. And I thought a good resolution, a very manageable, specific, concrete thing would be not to let that get away from me, to constantly keep it clean. And then I thought, that's way too ambitious. There's no way I'm going to do that. I can't even do that. I thought maybe this would be easier, abstain from something. So then I thought, okay, how about if I abstain from eating meat, maybe beef, maybe not all meat, maybe just certain select cuts of red meat. But anyway, abstain from eating meat once a week. I think that'd be good for me. It would be good for the planet. It might be good for our pocketbook. That'd be a good goal. So I think that's going to be my resolution. It's a specific, manageable micro resolution for the year.
So you're saying one day a week you will not
eat. One day a week.
That's good.
And by the way, did I say meat or did I say beef?
You said both.
Yeah, you said both.
Yeah. I think I'm going to have to narrow that down, or at least be specific. If I'm going to be honest with myself, I need to pick one of those. And I really don't know how ambitious I want to get with that because I love me some chicken. And chicken's a good, well, it's not really meat.
It's not just, even the new year and you're already backsliding. We're still days away.
I have,
but that, hey, that's the name of the game.
I have pre-backslid. I have backslid in advance of not even doing it. You're welcome. 312-981-7200. Think about that for a moment. And then as seriously or as comically as you can, just tell me what's a micro, manageable resolution for you to aspire to. I don't want any marathon runners calling in. I didn't run a marathon, I know. No, I want those of us that are challenged with something that is utterly doable but almost unattainable, like keeping your closet clean. I thought I'd do wash the car once a week, which I used to do, but that ship sailed. I'm not doing that anymore. And it bugs me. But yeah, maybe I should do that one, Griff, because I like a clean car. I need a clean car.
It's hard in the city.
It's hard in the city.
Last year, my resolution was to get more sleep, which is vague. And I still feel like I haven't totally attained it. So maybe, yeah, I need to put a number on it or something like
that. Right, like minimum 6 hours a night, 5 nights a week. I don't know how you do it. But
yeah, that's...
I think you got to quantify it.
But you got to shoot for something.
Yeah, well, didn't I just give you something to shoot for?
I don't think that that's... I think that I could do that pretty easily. I think I should be shooting for like 7 hours a night.
6 nights a week, something like that.
Yeah, yeah. The same way I think not eating beef once a week is maybe not, while we're paring down, I think maybe you could shoot a little higher.
Oh, really?
I think avoiding beef for one day is not that.
Well, I want to
I think you do that by accident. I think you'd be, oh, I didn't eat any beef today.
True, but I'm just, okay, fine.
I appreciate, though, the spirit.
Thank you for blowing out my candle in advance of my not even getting
it done. I want better for both of us.
Thank you. James, Joe, you guys got any? So having heard that, 312-981-7200. Call or text me now. Text me now. Tell me what your micro resolution is. Fellas, you got anything? Joe, you've got a big new year in front of you. Any resolutions you imagine?
You know, a couple of years ago, I did the New Year's resolution of flossing every day.
Tough.
Yeah, it is. But now I've developed the standard of doing it once a week. So I improved, and then I fell back a little bit.
I shouldn't laugh at that. But I don't think that really helps, Joe. I think flossing once a week is the same as never flossing.
Seriously?
That's not true.
I believe so.
Wow. That's a flossing snob.
Yeah, how often?
How could it be the same? It's 52 times a year. Is 52 better than zero?
No, it's not.
That makes no sense.
I think it does. The bacteria don't go, hey, guys, he just flossed. Better not come tomorrow. No, the bacteria will be there the next day. You're going to get 6 days.
Okay, well, it's at
your
least...
Your standards for some things are so low, and then your standards for other things are extremely high.
I didn't know we were doing the Vibe Score segment so early today.
I give that resolution.
But I'm sorry, Griff, are you saying that... that more than one floss a week is fairly ambitious on Joe's part?
I'm saying it's better than nothing. And you said it was the same as nothing.
I think Joe's kidding himself. 352 days.
Wow.
That's
well, again, it was a standard of at least once a week. So there are weeks where I do it more than once.
Joe, I think you're doing great.
Thank you. Thank you, Griff. I really appreciate it. Where's my participation flossing trophy?
Everybody gets a flossing trophy. Let's go into the newsroom. James, do you have anything you'd like to share?
Oh, yeah. I got a Fitbit a couple years ago and have been hitting 10,000 steps. But 3 months ago, my treadmill broke, and so I haven't been hitting that lately. So my goal is to get at least 10,000 steps again.
Yeah. Well, congratulations on obtaining a new coat hanger, then.
Yeah, right.
Is that what it is? Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah, it's just taking up space now.
I like some of our texts. Somebody said, I resolved to stop saying I mean before I say everything.
I like that.
I mean,
exactly. I really like that.
So I'm like is another one now.
Hit the gym 3 times a week.
There you go. Manageable, doable.
All that.
312-981-7200. We'll share your micro resolutions. Incidentally, it's a gray day, however warm it's been the last few. These are dreary, but I'm going to put sunlight in your life after this. I'm John Williams. Our producer is Griffin Filipich. Griffin, what's the text line say about micro resolutions from our listeners?
I like this one. It's tooth-related, but not in the way that we were talking about.
Hey, Joe, listen to this one.
It's a little different. I'm incorporating the toothbrush-to-toothbrush rule for my phone. I will not touch my phone after I brush my teeth in the morning. It will not touch my phone after I touch.
Wow,
brush my teeth
that.
At night.
There's a bunch of great new life metrics for people. One of them is only eat in a 6-hour window or never eat after 8 p.m. Pete McMurray is a great advocate of that. But I haven't heard the toothbrush. What's the description of that again, Griffin? The toothbrush to phone rule?
Toothbrush to toothbrush rule.
I won't use my won't look at my smartphone between my evening brush and my morning brush.
No, before you brush your teeth or after you brush your teeth.
Yeah, the title of it isn't that great, but the method of it is fantastic.
So when you wake up, you do not look at your phone until you brush your teeth.
Oh, wow. Well, that's not all that ambitious. So in other words...
You are so hard on people. This is crazy. You're not supposed to use it all day? People need it.
The period of time for which you are going to resolve this year to not use your phone is about 3 minutes.
I don't know about that, John. I roll over to my side. There's my nightstand. There's my phone. I'm on my phone for a good maybe 20 minutes.
Everyone does that.
I'm not going to tell you guys how to live, but here's how you should live.
My gosh.
Your phone should not be in your bedroom with you at night. That's why you've already got this issue.
How am I going to wake up? Then?
This is a method for dealing with that and getting to the place where you're talking about. And you're so judgmental.
A micro goal, you mean? Just something micro and manageable.
So text in your resolutions if you want to be criticized before you even get started on them.
Hey, if you want to be judged, give me a call. I'll tell you how you're deficient.
I think it's a great idea.
The phone lines will light up now.
What you thought it was is that you don't use your phone all day.
No, I thought overnight. Like, when you go to bed at night, you should not have your phone sitting next to you. And that if it's in the other room...
That's what it is.
Well,
it's you don't use it from the time you brush your teeth, or you don't use it. Not, whatever.
Go ahead. No, no. Walk me through this, because
you don't use it after you brush your teeth
at night.
Yeah.
All the
or
way to
before you brush your teeth in the morning.
Okay.
So that extends the whole night.
So you do get that 8-9 hours of
yes. That's like it's presumably that amount of time. Not using the phone.
I still don't like Joe rolling over in bed in the morning and looking at his phone.
See, I agree. It's definitely not a good habit, but I will say this. I'm a terrible person at waking up at the first alarm. I'm a guy that hits the snooze a lot. So the one thing the phone allows me to do is kind of slowly wake up to my day, and I can read something on Twitter and see if there was anything that happened the night before. It kind of eases me into my morning. Now I have nothing to justify looking at my phone after I brush my teeth and when I go to bed. That is a terrible, terrible habit. I'll try to play devil's advocate and justify the first one. But yeah, the second one is horrible.
Well, good luck to you on that, Joe.
Thank you.
Actually, my doctor told me that it was best to start your day with a blindingly bright screen 6 inches from your face day.
Griff, yeah. I'm on like 15% with my brightness, so don't. I've thought about that.
You know, that could be your goal, Joe. I'm going to go to 14%. I'll be looking at my phone all the time, but at 14% brightness, it's micro, it's manageable, it's specific.
I have to agree with the text. Now, I'm sorry that this has turned sour, but someone said, John is completely missing the point of a micro goal, which is where we started.
Yeah.
And it's not taking into account that someone starts that with a small step that can be a big improvement later on.
Yeah.
That's what that was your point, I think.
That was James' story, was we should have micro, quantifiable, manageable, not too ambitious goals.
Right.
I guess I just need to go back to the dictionary and look up the definition of the word ambitious, because it seems to me like you guys are taking very small bites.
Wow. Wow.
Baby steps.
That is
judge much?
Oh my gosh.
I gave my wife, Brenda, our annual, on the bright side, we're picking up more daylight speech. We were walking along the lake the other day, and it was kind of a gray day like this one. Pleasant. I mean, it was warm, but we are all pining for some sunlight. And so, Griff, I thought I would at least look up what the sunrise and sunset is in Chicago.
Sunset.
And this is encouraging news. We are picking up around an extra half minute of daylight now. Isn't that nice to know? And each day we pick up more than the day before. So you're getting about 30 more seconds of daylight today, tomorrow. You get another 30 seconds, maybe 35 seconds of daylight. The shortest days of the year here are, of course, December 21st and 22nd, when we get, give or take, 9 hours and 7 minutes and 47 seconds of daylight. That's all. The sun comes up December 21st at 7:14 in the morning, and it sets on that shortest day of the year at 4:22 in the afternoon, which is about where we are now. But again, we're picking up a little each day. So today, for instance, we are going to get not 9 hours, 7 minutes, and 46 seconds of daylight, but we're going to get 9 hours and 9 minutes and 17 seconds of daylight. We have already picked up an extra minute and a half of daylight each day. And if you're looking for a nice benchmark of daylight in Chicago, circle January 6 on your calendar. Starting that day, you get over a minute extra of daylight each day. Joe, you'll be 2 days into your marriage. That'll be January 4th, January 5th, January 6th. And you can turn over there in the bed with your wife after you've looked at your phone for like an hour. And you can say, hey, what do you know?
What red meat are we going to eat today and not floss afterwards? But yes.
No, this is the whole day that he goes without eating red meat, Joe. Big steps
right.
From him. Big, big, huge steps we're taking in the new year.
And you can say, hey, hon, we are going to pick up over a minute of extra daylight today. The longest day of the year, of course, is June 20th, when we get just under 15 hours and 14 minutes of daylight. The sun comes up then at 5:15, sets at 8:29 in Chicago. And, of course, it stays light much longer than that. I mean, it's 9 o'clock. You're still playing wiffle ball out front or back. But right now, we are at 9 hours and 7 minutes. The longest days will be 15 hours and 14 minutes. But again, you're picking up about 35 to 40 seconds a day and a little bit more each day going forward. Starting January 6th, you get an extra minute of daylight every day. It's going to be cold. We're going to have dreary days, but just keep that in the back of your pocket. Who is the number one earning athlete in Chicago? Forbes has, everybody's got their lists out, and the Forbes list this year is the top 100 earners in sports in the world. Of the top 100 earning athletes in the world, only two are from Chicago. This is why our teams are terrible. We don't pay them enough.
I think two out of 100, let's think.
Is that good or is that not good?
Let's do a little math.
We're Chicago.
That's 1/50th of the earners on that list. We are one city. The world is a big place.
Fair enough.
It might be somewhat representative.
Third largest city in the United States, the richest nation in the world. Yeah. Although, to your point, Griff, Lionel Messi is number one in the world. He plays soccer, not here. Cristiano Ronaldo's number two.
Right.
They make $127 and $109 million a year. Neymar plays soccer, $105 million. The top three are soccer players. Then it's Canelo Alvarez, number four, a boxer. Then it's Roger Federer. How about that? Number five earner in the world, $93 million. In part because he gets $86 million of those 93 as endorsements. The purses aren't big. And they don't have salaries. They're independent contractors. But the endorsements make Federer number five in the world. Only two athletes from Chicago crack the top 100.
Can I make my guess?
Go ahead.
Jason Hayward, Khalil Mack?
That is an incorrect guess.
Both of them?
I didn't say that.
Okay.
Let's do this. 312-981-7200. First person to call in and tell us who are the top two earning athletes in Chicago. And Joe did give you a bit of an assist there. We'll win $50 million. We'll win a pizza from Lou Malnati's. We'll get you a pizza from Lou Malnati's. Only one woman on the list. I'll bet you guys know who that is. Mr. Sportsman, go ahead and tell me who the only female on the list of the top 100 earning athletes is.
Julie Ertz or Megan Rapinoe?
Even I got this one, Joe. Come on now. This is literally the only thing I would have
done. Am I totally blanking on something?
Yeah.
Venus Williams? Serena. Okay. I apologize for my fourth guess.
Russell Wilson is number six on the list, then Aaron Rodgers, then LeBron James. $89 million for LeBron. Steph Curry, Kevin Durant. Tiger Woods is still... And he had a nice win last year. He's back. He's 11th on the list. He earned $9 million on the links and $54 million in endorsements. Then Ben Roethlisberger. How about that? Number 12. Huh. Here's what I'm looking for, Griff. They got to get them both right. I'll take a commercial break. Let's get the right answer after that. The top two earners in Chicago. The only two athletes to crack Forbes 100 earning athletes in the world. Joe gave you a guess. He gave you a hand, but he didn't get it right. We'll get the right answer after this. Griff, if we don't get a right answer, I will give the right answer. And again, this is emblematic of the problem. The reason Chicago sports isn't good enough, I don't know, maybe we're paying commensurate with our place in the world. Griff said we're a pretty big city. We've got two of the 100, so maybe that's all we deserve. But none of them are, well, let's just see what we can get here. Hey, Cindy, you're on WGN Radio. What's your guess? You're on the air.
Hi, my guess is Patrick Kane and Khalil Mack.
Khalil Mack is correct and Patrick Kane is not.
Oh, okay.
Hockey players don't make the list of the 100 at all, in fact.
Oh, unfortunately.
Yeah, I know. I think you're right. Thanks for the phone call. I mean... just because that's the way it works. Hockey isn't as international a sport as it is. It's not that big in the United States relative to baseball, football, basketball, or for that matter, boxing in the world. And there's just not the profits there. Kane and Taves, if any two athletes should get paid the most in Chicago, it would arguably be them. What do they get, Joe? What do they get?
So they signed a, they both signed identical contracts, 8 years, $84 million. This was back in 2014. So they receive $10.5 million per year.
Yeah. Which is a lot. I mean, you can't feel bad for these guys. But if you said, how good is Patrick Kane's for the Blackhawks relative to anybody else for any other team in Chicago, Kane should get paid the most. And the Blackhawks are very profitable, but it's not Major League Baseball. It's not boxing. It's not soccer. Dave, you're on WGN Radio. Top two paid athletes in Chicago are whom?
I had Anthony Rizzo along with Khalil Mack.
Mack is right. Rizzo is wrong.
Okay, well, that was a good guess.
It was. I'll give you one more clue. If you get this, I'll tell you. You just won yourself. Oh, wait. Griff said, wait. We've got a correct answer on the other line. Oh, you were that close to getting a pizza.
Hey, John.
Yes, sir.
I was at your fastest round of golf, and I was Zorro's dad. You'll remember me.
I do. Well, thank you for listening, and thank you for remembering that.
Love your show. I'll look for the answer.
Okay, you keep listening, Dave. We did the fastest round of golf a couple of times. Tried to set the world record. Came close to injuring ourselves. Ron says he knows on line two for the Lou Malnati's pizza. Ron, you're on WGN. Go ahead.
I got Khalil Mack and John Lester.
John Lester, is it? Khalil makes $55 million. Lester makes just over $25 million a year. Of the top 100 paid athletes in the world, Lester is 97, I think. Khalil is number 13 on the list of highest paid athletes in the world. How about that? So well done, sir. I don't know. It looks to me like this year Khalil is overpaid. Last year he wasn't. I'll let you all argue amongst yourselves about is Lester worth $25 million, but that's what he's getting playing baseball for the Cubs. So the Cubs and the Bears, top two paying teams in Chicago for single athletes. Hey, go get a Lou Malnati's pizza on us, okay, Ron?
Hey, thanks, King John.
Thank you for listening. Griff, you talked to him off the air. Does that sound about right to you, Joe? Any wisdom to add to that list?
So just to clarify, this is annual salary.
Right.
Okay. That's where...
Who are you thinking of?
Well, I would have stuck with my guess of Jason. Well, it actually, I believe it would have been Jason Hayward and John Lester. John Lester, a $155 million contract. Jason Hayward, a $184 million contract. And, I mean, just to put that into perspective for the caller who said about Patrick Kane and Jonathan Toews, how, you know, hockey players... I mean, they make chump change compared to what these baseball players are making. Jason Hayward makes more money than Jonathan Toews and Patrick Kane's salaries combined.
Combined, yeah. And more endorsement money is available for NFL players and MLB athletes than NHL players, too. I mean, when's the last time you were watching TV and a hockey player came up and endorsed Rolex watches or soda pop or beer or something like that? I suppose it happens, but not much.
I do believe it's growing. I do. I think hockey purists and diehard fans would disagree, but I mean, maybe it's a biased comment because of how hockey has grown in this city over the past decade.
Right.
But, you know, 15 years ago, a Blackhawk would walk down the street and you couldn't recognize who they were. And actually, Duncan Keith once mentioned how when he first started with the team, they went out to a bar and were like, hey, we're Blackhawks. Can we get a table? And they go, sorry, we don't do anything to support the military here.
Oh, gee, that's funny.
Like, that's how much the times have changed in the
hockey
world. I
think Patrick Kane is probably one of the most recognizable athletes in Chicago. Football players have helmets on. I mean, maybe you would recognize Khalil Mack. Maybe you wouldn't, right? You'd recognize Mitch Trubisky, but not for poor Mitch. You'd recognize baseball players, certainly on the north side, and some from the south side. And then you wouldn't recognize any of the Chicago Bulls because nobody watches. So there's that. I mean, a 7-foot guy with red hair, okay, he plays for the Bulls. But that's about it. So that's where we are on that. One other just note, I was just going through the 100 athletes, and Butler University's now Boston Celtics' Gordon Hayward. Wow. Gordon is on the list. I follow Butler basketball. It's my passion. My son went to school there, played baseball there, went to classes with Gordon Hayward. In fact, they were the same major before Gordon decided that millions of dollars would be better than a degree in engineering. So Gordon is number 40 on the list, making $34 million a year. Top stories in Chicago. Just the last list I want to do. The Tribune did actually, I'm looking at the Sun-Times version of this, but I asked the Chicago Tribune's Eric Zorn, my fellow mincing rascal, to join me on the phone for a minute. Hi, Eric. How are you? Good morning.
I'm good. Good morning, John. How are you?
Really good. I'm sorry. I thought I had the Tribune in front of me when I printed this out. It's the Sun-Times. I hope you don't mind my referencing the enemy newspaper here.
I don't. I just hope you don't look at Channel 7's top 10 stories of the year. Did you see that?
No.
See what they did?
No.
Five of them were about Jussie Smollett.
Well, so our news click at WGNRadio.com said which of these three should be... We gave you the three top stories of the year according to the Sun-Times and then said at least put them in order. And the Sun-Times listing has Jussie Smollett as the number two story. Lori Lightfoot's election is... number one, and Jussie Smollett is number two. What's your thought about that?
Well, clearly, Lori Lightfoot is that's a huge story of an African-American lesbian becoming mayor of Chicago. That's huge. It's going to change the way the city runs for the next few years. The Jussie Smollett story is interesting, obviously, because it's going to impact, I think, the Cook County State's Attorney's race. But I don't know. I mean, and it's probably the most talked about story of the year. Certainly, you know, you and I have talked about it many times on the podcast, and people talk to me about it at parties all the time. It's something people are very interested in. But its importance, I think, it pales behind that. I mean, I would put the federal investigation of corruption in Illinois at number two, with a bullet possibly being the most important development of the year, because we may see a number of very high-profile dominoes falling in Springfield, including Michael Madigan, if things go the way they might go. So
I would put the Chicago teachers' strike in the top. Really, if you talk about it impacting families in Chicago, the Chicago teachers' union strike was huge, and is going to be impactful for years to come.
Well, it's going to impact our budgets for sure, and yeah, I mean it was a big story. Yeah, that's certainly a big story. But it's all, I mean, in some ways, it's all rolled into the Mary Lightfoot story.
Maybe so. Yeah.
What's her? Yeah.
And it's funny because you say that she's an African American lesbian as the mayor of Chicago. I get that, but I think what is also equally unique about or important about Lori Lightfoot's resume is the fact that she's just this no-nonsense, fairly transparent. I'm not putting up with... Talk about a swamp cleaner. I think that's Lori Lightfoot's agenda. I think that's transformative, too. Hopefully, it's transformative.
It looks like it, yeah. I certainly like the way she seems to cut to the chase. And, yeah, I mean, I think that her election and her style and her priorities are going to have a big impact on the city. And so far, I pretty much like what I see from her.
Five of the top 10 were Jussie Smollett stories on Channel 7?
On Channel 7's list of the top 10 stories of the year, yeah.
Okay, well, then I think it does beg the question, what's news then? Because clearly the Jussie Smollett story, remember, it was here 12 months. It was last January all the way to today. That arc is still in play. That's still a news story. But it's not the most important story. The only meat you can get on that hook is that it impacts maybe the state's attorney's office. It will, Kim Fox's reelection. But
it's going to play a big role, I believe, in the primary. The primary is March 17th, and I think her challengers in the Democratic primary are going to go after her hard on this. And the media is going to keep asking her this question. I heard her on your show, and she really didn't answer the question. You tried like five different ways, and she wouldn't answer the question. Why did she do what she did with Jussie Smollett? How does she explain that? And that gets to her honesty, her trustworthiness, and all kinds of things that people want in a state's attorney. So it's a story. It's definitely a big story. But, yeah, I would put it in perspective.
It was one of the most fun stories of the year. It was
my goodness.
It was the most bizarre. Actually, it wasn't the most fun. I'll get to the most fun story of the year in a second. It was the most bizarre story of the year. So this list has Lightfoot 1, Smollett 2, Chicago Teachers Strike 3, Eddie Johnson's exit number 4, the R. Kelly story is 5, baby cut from womb, boy, that's a hell of a headline, Clarissa Figueroa's deception began in late 2018. You remember the story of the woman and her daughter and her boyfriend who lured another woman into their place and extracted the child from the womb. The baby and the mother both died. All three have pleaded not guilty to that story. The next story on my list is Humboldt Park alligator. That would be Chance the Snapper. The ongoing federal probe of guys like Edward Burke, Danny Solis, Luis Arroyo.
Wait a minute. You're saying that the Chance the Snapper is a more important story than... I mean, not saying you're saying it, but they're saying that it's a more important story than the federal probe?
I sent an email to Stefano Esposito over at the Sun-Times, and I said, Stefano, I'm going to use your story. It's really good, and he's a nice reporter. But he didn't know how the newspaper, it sounded like, was going to order his... So it wasn't clear to him or to me if these are in order of importance or they're just the top 10.
Or the question also becomes, you know, what is an important story or just what is an interesting story? Chance the Snapper, that was an interesting story. I don't think we believe there's going to be an infestation of reptiles in our lagoons around the city. It was a one-off story.
It was the most fun story of the year.
Yeah, I mean, I would say it is violence in Chicago just in general on that list in terms of the trends, the crime trends and so on? Because that's also quite interesting. We had a significant drop in the number of murders. It's still way too high, but I think we're going to be under 500, which is for the first time in maybe 5 years.
Yeah, I don't know if you put that under the Eddie Johnson headline, but that's not really what we talk about when we're talking about Eddie Johnson. So
no, we're talking about
crime in Chicago its fall. Is not in the top 10. The ongoing federal probe is some of these dum-dums in the city. And then you've got recreational marijuana legalized come the first of the year. Lincoln Yards and the 78th, the two major block developments in the city, round out their top 10 in Chicago this year. So, Eric, I'll let you go, but conspicuously absent may be just some sort of headline about crime, huh?
I would think, yeah, and you know, I guess you know we can always quibble about the priority there and you know what order they're in, but I mean those are certainly the stories that we talked about quite a bit this year, and yeah, I won't quibble with most of it, but it's you know when you're talking about stories that are gonna matter in the long run, I think legalizing marijuana is gonna be a big story. It's gonna be a bigger story, much bigger story in 2020 than it was this year, right? And of course, Mayor Lightfoot and this federal probe. I think that may be the number one story. If you want to do that list now, the number one story of 2020 local story may be that. So.
Now, I think the number one story of 2020 is going to be that the White Sox are going to make the playoffs.
Yes.
The Bears not making the playoffs actually could be in that list as well. Think about the time and attention from August to December that this city spent on the failure of the Chicago Bears. I'm sorry, that may not be important to you, but then again, Chance the Snapper's on the list, and people talked about that a lot.
Well, people, and the build-up to the season of the Bears. Everyone thought this was a team that might get to the Super Bowl, certainly a playoff team. Huge disappointment, yeah.
Eric Zorn writes for the Chicago Tribune. You can read him digitally, chicagotribune.com/Zorn. He's still in the print edition of that fine newspaper, and he's a regular on our Mincing Rascals podcast, which we drop on Thursdays. Good to hear you, Eric.
Nice to talk to you, John. We'll see you soon.
If you do not already, today would be a good day to subscribe to a newspaper. Remember, if you want to call in or text into the show, we always like that. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Okay, I made a boo-boo. I said two in the top 100. Who did I miss there, Joe Brand?
Otto Porter Jr., who's only played 9 games this year, dealing with a left foot injury. You know what? If we're going to tie this all together, you said nobody knows the Bulls because nobody watches. Maybe that should be your New Year's resolution, your micro resolution to watch one Bulls game a week.
I'm not doing that. And I love me some basketball, but you know I'm a season ticket holder this year for DePaul. I like watching Big Ten hoops, and of course, we're the Northwestern station as well. And then I watch every Butler game twice, so my basketball plate's pretty full.
You can't just transfer not watching one of those Butler games twice to just watching one more Bulls game.
Well, then I wouldn't have a good scouting report for the next game.
And who's asking for your input after the scouting report?
My inner self.
No one from the team yet. But now I think it'll get out there.
Hey, guys.
People start talking.
There's this guy in Chicago. He's got a radio show, and he watches the games twice.
Griff, have you seen the movie Fever Pitch?
Oh, yes. Actually, I was half quoting that movie when saying that. Yeah.
What are you guys talking about?
He's trying to explain to his girlfriend, his new girlfriend, why he has to go down to spring training to see the Red Sox. And because they scout the players and they see all the prospects. And she goes, and the Red Sox ask for your input? And he goes, well, not yet, but it's...
Oh, no kidding.
I thought that I could get away with cribbing a line from Fever Pitch because it's such a maligned movie. But Joe's there.
I didn't even know that was a movie. So you
keeping
were
me honest.
Wow, Griff, if you're going to drop a line like that.
Well, I was reworking it. I believe there was some reworking happening there.
I think you get to brag about that. Usually when guys...
No,
quote
you don't brag
movies.
About quoting Fever Pitch. It's not a good movie.
Fair
I
enough.
Love it.
Fair enough.
Joe, how do you feel about Fever Pitch?
I think it's a great movie.
Oh, okay.
Granted, teenage Joe Brand watching a romantic comedy about baseball. That was...
I once watched it with someone and they were like... I don't like watching Jimmy Fallon like kiss people. Like he's not a good like a romantic lead, and his career in the movies was very short lived. So there might be something to that.
Speaking of movies, what did you watch last night?
I saw Little Women at the Music Box last night.
What did you see before that?
Uncut Gems.
Wow, you're on an Oscar roll.
Two nights in a row. Well, that remains to be seen. These are great movies that I recommend everyone go see. I don't know how well they're going to do at the Oscars. It's very up in the air for both of these, actually.
Uncut Gems, give me that.
Adam Sandler plays a jeweler in the Diamond District in New York who has what we find pretty quickly to be a gambling problem. And he meets Kevin Garnett, and they have a connection. And he believes that Kevin Garnett... Well, I won't give away too much more, but
give
he believes that
bit.
Kevin Garnett... will be his path to getting out of a lot of gambling debt if he just makes a big bet on Kev.
On a game that Kevin's going to play in?
Right. This is set in 2012 when he was on the Celtics.
Got it. I got it. So is Garnett corrupt in that? Does he comply with the scheme? Is he...
Well, he... I don't want to...
I don't know. Listen, put it this way. I know everything you said based on the trailer.
Yeah, that's true. I want to stay in the trailer, though.
Stay in the trailer zone, then.
Yeah.
Stay in the trailer park, as it will. So then... Did you like the movie?
It's
because
fantastic,
it
yes.
looks electric in the trailers. You can't watch that trailer and go, this looks really fun.
It's made by these brothers called the Safdie brothers, Josh and Benny Safdie. They've made about five movies before this. The previous two are called Heaven Knows What and Good Time. Good Time starred Robert Pattinson as a sort of small-time crook with a botched bank robbery. And they're these gritty New York movies. But when you say gritty, I think that conjures some kind of slow, dark, I don't know, something kind of pat. These movies are alive, and they are really dark and gross in ways that you've not before imagined, I think. It's a very new thing they're doing. Good Time is actually a little more accessible. I'm sorry, the new one, Uncut Gems, is very accessible.
Accessible, really, because...
And their previous movies were so... one's about a heroin addict, the other one's about Robert Pattinson, and they're really infused with like the street life in New York in a way that is probably not for everybody. I think this one is more accessible. People have come out saying it's very stressful, which I suppose is true, but it's also very funny and just really intense, great time.
Our friend Kathy O'Malley saw it, and I don't know how much Kathy liked it. Longtime WGN host here and great friend to a lot of us. And Kathy, I don't know if she liked the movie or not, but I know her comment was that these are not good people. This is kind of a hard watch movie in that sense. I'm sorry, Kathy, I'm paraphrasing you, but I think that was the gist of it.
I mean, the Adam Sandler character, Howard, is not...
Likeable.
He doesn't make one good decision in the whole movie.
Well, and there was another quote from some highfalutin couple of critics that were going back and forth about it, and their comment was, there are no... What was it? Something like redeemable or even recognizable human qualities in these people.
I would definitely disagree with that.
Tell me how good Kevin Garnett is in
the movie. Fantastic.
Does he have a cameo or does he play a role?
I mean, the story is entirely centered around him.
So
but,
he's acting,
but
he's talking, he's...
He's definitely in... He's still... He's not... He's in about, I'd say, five or six scenes with... And one major scene. With,
yeah.
And he's fantastic.
Is he better than LeBron James was in...
Well, LeBron's great in the movie he was in. It's completely different. Tenor, that was Trainwreck, and that was a comedy, and he was hilarious. I think they're, and Kevin Garnett, it's a totally different thing, but they really channeled his energy, his passion, and his, you know, he's kind of big-headed and likes to talk crap, and they got into that in an interesting way.
We got to go on a scale of 1 to 23, Juju Bees, you give Uncut Gems.
I give it a 20, 21.
And Little Women?
Same thing.
Wow.
We could talk about it later, but I absolutely loved Little Women also.
1057, and yet on one list of something that just came out and should be on everybody's list for best of in 2019. But it came out so late in the year that it doesn't make the list because all the journalists had deadlines prior to it coming out. Is the John Mulaney special. Wow, is that good. We'll play a little of that for you after the news. Now it's 11:09. This is WGN. Hi, it's John Williams, and you hear me weekdays from 9 to noon on WGN. I have not, my career, been a big fan of Don Imus, but you probably heard that Don Imus passed away, and as I read a little bit about him this morning, I was pretty shocked at some of the, the things that the guy did. And I wondered if in the obituaries, if the Rutgers women's basketball team remark was going to come up and how soon it was going to come up. I guess you knew it would. And in some of the obits, it's the third sentence, which is a disservice to maybe just all of the other crazy that that guy was involved in or the career that he had. And this is coming not from a fan of Don Imus necessarily. I picked him up late in his career and I just didn't understand it. But then I started to read about him, and whatever it was that it was, he had one wild, wacky, crazy and successful life. And some Chicago names pop up in the Don Imus story, too. He's passed away at the age of 79. He was diagnosed about a decade ago with stage 2 prostate cancer and has passed away. The family didn't say exactly what it was that took him, but we presume those things would be connected. They're going to have a small private family ceremony for him. And if you go to his wiki page, just here's the Don Imus story writ small. Born in Riverside, California, into a wealthy family. His mom and dad owned a 35,000-acre ranch called The Willows near Kingman, Arizona. He hated school. At 15, his parents divorced. His dad died when he was 20. Imus dropped out of high school and joined the United States Marine Corps at Base Camp Pendleton. He left the Marines with an honorable discharge and secured work as a window dresser in San Bernardino before he was fired for performing strip teases on the mannequins for passersby. Imus then moved to Hollywood with his brother in an attempt to find success as musicians and songwriters, but they struggled to get radio DJs to play their songs on the air. This left Imus homeless, resorting to sleeping in a laundry and hitchhiking back to Arizona. After dropping out of the University of the Pacific, Imus worked as a brakeman on the Southern Pacific Railroad and in a uranium mine in Arizona. You'd think that given his background, driving a train or handling uranium might not be perfect occupations for him, but there he was. He suffered a mining accident that broke both of his legs and collapsed one lung. In 1966, he enrolled at the Don Martin School of Radio and Television Arts and Sciences in Hollywood. He was thrown out for being uncooperative, but he studied enough to get his broadcasting license. After hearing a morning radio DJ at KUTY in Palmdale, California, Imus went to the station and successfully persuaded the owner to hire him. Imus was an instant success at the station. In 2 months, he'd become number one in the ratings for his time slot and earned a Billboard Award for Air Personality of the Year in a medium-sized market. He then had a short stint at a station in Stockton, California, from which he was fired. The incident that caused his exit is in dispute, but may have been a bit he did on the air where he told a local McDonald's that he called up on his radio show to cook 1,200 hamburgers for the National Guard. He said he was a commander. The segment influenced later an FCC ruling that required all radio DJs to identify themselves when they make phone calls on the air. In 1970, Imus left that station for a station in Cleveland for a $50,000 a year salary. I'm almost done, but I'll just get you to the real start of his fame. December 2nd, 1971, 3 years into his radio career, he started at WNBC in New York City as the morning man with a $100,000 salary. Went from a uranium mine to morning man in New York. 100 grand. On his second day, he overslept and missed the show. By early 1980s, he was earning as much as $10,000 a night performing stand-up. He started to drink heavily during this period. It soon affected his working life. He started to miss work and became increasingly unmanageable. In 1973, he missed 100 days of work. He described himself as awful and a jerk at this time. He returned to Cleveland because he lost his job and began an afternoon drive show in 1978 there. In 1979, he got himself back to WNBC in New York, starting at 5:30 in the morning. By this time, he was heavily into cocaine until he quit in 1983. He continued to drink, and his on- and off-air behavior became erratic. He turned up for work without shoes. He slept on park benches with large amounts of money in his pockets. And on the story goes. You know who used to do features with him is our own Ro Khan. Are you listening to some of this, Ro?
Yeah, I am. It's an amazing story.
So what did you, how did you know him or what did you do with him?
So when he was at WABC in the late, I mean, he'd been through a billion different radio stations at that point, but he was doing mornings on WABC, and I was doing a feature after Paul Harvey had passed away. I replaced him in New York, LA, and Chicago, and so that feature started running on IMUS, his show, so I would go on his show to promote the feature.
What would your feature be?
It was called The Ro Report. It was basically a news package every day set to music. Ahead of its time, Jeff.
No, it all works. It's good. That's good. So you were putting that feature on his show, but you weren't in daily contact with him.
No, I was in contact with him only when we were promoting the show, and I'd met him a number of times throughout the years in and out of New York, and he's a it's interesting. I think the best comparison to him in terms of his style, his sound, and all that was Larry Lujack. And, you know, there's a lot of argument about who stole what from whom.
Yeah.
And you know, I think that Lujack really is, you know, patient zero, if you will, for, the reluctant cowboy act. And that's what that's very much what Imus was, sort of a gruff sounding guy. But what to me was most fascinating about him, and the thing I appreciated most about him, was, as you'll recall, he was also... it was the morning show on MSNBC, right? They set him up in the studio, and it was him and Tim Russert, and it was, you know, presidents and potentates and congressmen and senators and all these Washington.
Kind of like Morning Joe now.
Yeah. Well, and Joe Scarborough, I know, gave him credit in when he commented on the passing for sort of setting the table for those guys. But that's exactly what it was. And you know, here's a guy who was kind of, you know, this reluctant cowboy DJ, ex-DJ, now basically running Washington in a lot of ways. I mean, it was the must-see television show and radio show for what was happening in D.C.
I guess, and you know, I guess some people connect with the show, some people don't, right? Some people like Howard Stern, some people like Joe Scarborough. I would watch Imus's act sometimes on TV, seeing him there mumbling with his cowboy hat on TV, and I just didn't get it. I didn't know what he was saying was so provocative or insightful, at least on that TV show, and I can't say I was a fan. I was more mystified. I don't think I was angry at him, Ro. I didn't understand the appeal.
Well, I think it was later in his career he started being less controversial. Right. I mean, he did all kinds of things. As we know, I mean, he changed radio. You mentioned that in the obit. He changed radio in the sense that the courts had to rule on whether or not radio pranks could actually go.
By the way,
could happen.
My understanding of the rule that said that if you call somebody on the air and put them on the air, a radio prank. I thought that rule stemmed from something that happened to WGN with Wally Phillips. Maybe it happened more
than
once.
All of it. I think I think eventually the courts had to weigh in because it was going on.
You've got to stop that. Yeah.
Right. And then they had to reconfigure it after Brandmeier. You know, I mean, so Chicago's got a lot of skin in that game, screwing around.
No kidding. Okay. So then I just wanted to bounce off of you a couple of the controversies and how he was judged for them. Do you have another minute?
Mm-hmm.
By the way, you know who also appears in this story is Clarence Page of the Chicago Tribune, the columnist who's still putting it out at the Chicago Tribune site. And I just wanted to feature that part of the story after this. 10:30 on WGN-TV. Don Imus passed away at the age of 79, the legendary shock jock and talk jock. You may have seen him on TV in the last stint in his career. But he came up through radio the way a lot of us have, doing wacky stunts on the radio, controversial stunts. He was a guy who sometimes couldn't get out of his own way, but he just had some innate talent. He had a bestseller, a novel that he wrote that was on the New York Times bestseller list for 7 weeks. He was behind TV projects. He was behind movie projects. Just about everything he did ended up going well, almost in spite of himself. And yet he also shot himself in the foot a lot. Imus passed away at the age of 79. Rokan worked with him back in the 19-something-or-others. When was that?
The late 2000s.
Late 2000s. Yeah. And so
I worked with him. I just want to make that clear. I appeared on a show a number of times, and I had a feature that ran on a show.
My introduction's better. So facts be damned.
I know. Well, people will go, hey, what are you doing?
Are you doing talking up Imus when you really didn't work with him that much? So yeah. Part of the controversies about him include this thing that he said about the Rutgers women's basketball team, which I won't repeat, but he said a couple of things that were deemed to be sexist and racist, and he later apologized for them, in part at the behest of Clarence Page, a columnist for the Chicago Tribune. Clarence was on his show sometimes, and Clarence said, you have to apologize and say that you will stop characterizing black women that way. And he said he would, but I don't know that that's a promise he was able to keep perfectly for the rest of his career. This is my question to you, though, Ro. How was that handled? And I don't know, maybe relative to today's world, how was that handled?
Well, I think it's one of the earliest examples that we have now of this kind of moment of the cancel culture, as we call it, right? That he was... it was always a groundbreaker. And this was a case where his entire career, you know, was predicated on this show and saying things that were a little out of the box. Now, again, by the time he'd gotten to the MSNBC morning show, that was a simulcast of his radio show, it had changed. I mean, he wasn't quite as shocky as he had been before. And he just, you know, fell into whatever that was at that moment. And as you pointed out, for those just joining us, and you read his obit, he always battled alcoholism and drug abuse and what appears to be, I'm not a doctor, but, you know, it appears to be, you know, like a depressive personality disorder and stuff like that. I mean, he slept on park benches. I mean, he had some wackiness to him. So I think there were moments where he just couldn't control his instincts. And, you know, the rule in New York radio is always articulated by Howard Stern is if you think it, say it. And that's and I think that he and Imus were very much like that. And that competition alone, I mean, the stuff they used to say about each other and do to each other over the years.
Even when they were on the same station.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Well, I think in private parts, in the book at least, there's a part about Imus. You know, when Imus got out of rehab in the late 1980s, he won of his stints in rehab. Remember that Howard Stern had sent him a bottle of champagne to congratulate him. that's a high comedy bit right there. But, but you know, but now, and we can laugh about that, but now, you know, you're not supposed to laugh about those things. And so that's where Imus always was. He was always in that. He was always playing sort of in those waters.
And I think there's a certain complicity by station management and station owners and radio corporations because, for instance, after his stint where he's now using cocaine, he's sleeping on park benches, he's not showing up to work. What was the station? I'll find it right here. WNBC hires him back again, a 5-year deal worth $500,000 a year, and that's in 1981. I mean, that was a gigantic contract, particularly for a guy like this. So why did they do it? They know he doesn't show up for work. They know he has abuse problems, and they know he says crazy things. But they hired him because he did. He got ratings. So I think there's, you know, when companies go, oh, gee, that's beneath our values and stuff, I think it's they speak out of both sides of their mouth when they do that.
Sorry for laughing. But, yeah, when they say things like that, I think it's crocodile tears.
And yeah, so then I suppose in retrospect, if you look up the whole story about the Rutgers women's basketball team, you know, what he said was beyond inappropriate, maybe particularly for that time. I'm not sure where the needle is on speech around some of these issues these days. But that really was a career changer for him, wasn't it?
Oh, for sure. I mean, it changed everything that he was doing, right? It moved him. I think he continued on with a syndicated radio show.
Yeah, he did.
But you know, that's the funny thing about where we are now in the culture. I think I've read a lot of stuff. I've always thought this, that the modern political situation in America is very much predicated on talk radio. I think talk radio was the first successful medium to, you know, the whole, like, and I'm using this in air quotes, tell it like it is, right? Say whatever you're thinking, as opposed to whatever's appropriate or whatever might be right. And it just is, it started there. And then a lot of the talking points that have gotten echoed throughout the ensuing 25 or 30 years have basically come from talk radio talking points, or at least talk radio temperature. You know, and I think Imus is certainly one of those guys, right? He wanted to be, and I don't think that Imus would have even described himself as a conservative, you know, or a Republican. I think he was just, again, we go back to that reluctant cowboy. He's just, you know, a man of the people kind of thing, even though he came from a wealthy family.
Yeah.
Went into the Marine Corps. He, you know, shoot all of those kind of trappings, and he's, he turned himself into what he turned himself into, but it was a troubled life, and he had certainly a ton of downs, but some great ups.
Well, he certainly showed to radio people today, TV people today, and politicians today that you can crash and burn and survive it. That sometimes being outlandish can be a brand that people will somehow embrace. And that sure worked for him. It sure worked for Howard Stern. It works to some degree for some people. And I think we should also note, as we wrap this up, that he was also charitable to veterans, to children with cancer. Those were a couple of the things that he spent a lot of time putting a lot of money towards, just as part of his narrative.
Yeah, I think the funny thing is that you can be kind of a jerk on the air and behind the scenes, first of all, a decent human being, which obviously he was for all the things that he did. But he also, you could also be a business guy. And I think that was the take on him, was that he was very good at understanding where the clients were, understanding where how the business of radio works and the business of broadcasting works. And he was always very good on that side. And I think that's why he kept getting hired.
Are you back? You were off last week. You back in the saddle on Monday?
Back on the 6th.
Back on the 6th?
Yeah.
What's today's date? Hold on a second.
I don't even know. What is it, 28th? I don't know.
Well, it's good to hear your voice, my friend. We'll listen for you soon.
Thanks, John.
That's Rokan, and I appreciate him. I thought, well, sure, he'll come on Saturday. He's working Monday. He's still got a little time off. Enjoy, Ro. Rest. It's 11:29. This is WGN. It's 11:32 on WGN. You know, this is my last show from 10 to noon on Saturdays. We're moving to early afternoons after the first of the year. You know that Bob Surratt's going to do the morning show. Ro's coming back from vacation. Our show, amongst the changes, is going to go to 1 to 3, sometimes 1 to 4 on Saturdays. So I don't know what's going to happen to this little feature we've been doing, but Griff, you always start us with a song. Always comes at us with a song about now, not just because we're killing time, but because he said, no, here's some music you should know a little something about. What were we listening to there, Griff?
That's a song that came out maybe 6-7 months ago, or it's been around for some time, but It's been on my mind because I've seen it popping up on year-end lists, and it occurred to me that I hadn't played it yet on this segment. So
who is that?
It's Charlie XCX, the pop star, featuring Christine and the Queens, a French pop star who actually made one of the best albums of the past few years, I think, called Chris. I would look that one up. And the song's called Gone. They collaborated for this single, which sounds like a number one smash hit, but it was more of a middling hit, but still one of the best songs of the year. It didn't break through the way I thought it would.
Name of the artist again is
Charlie XCX.
So I knew that. Who is Charlie with there?
Christine and the Queens.
Christine and the Queens, yeah. Yeah. And Chris is a good album to look up from these groups?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So now we score them on a scale of 1 to 100. I thought you were going to play 100 Gex for us.
Oh, well, I would love to return to that topic, and we can...
We'll get
Joe, do you remember the group that I played last time?
I can't say I do.
It was not loved by the rest of the panel.
By America.
Only by me. You said it sounded like Crazy Frog.
That's right. Now I remember.
And you were right. And I loved that observation. I just, I've been rubbing it, not rubbing it in your face, but it's just an interesting thing to return to because it was the number one album of the year on the New York Times. From the New York Times critic.
Okay, so then you have
I felt quite justified.
What is going on with America?
I know. Well, this is a man clearly with a hearing problem, but we'll get to that in just a second.
Maybe we'll bring that back later.
The song that Griffin played with the Queens and the X's, I'm going to give that a 75. It sounds like what I've heard before, Griff. It didn't cut through for me, but it sounded pretty good.
Yeah, sure.
How about you, Joe? Where were you on that one?
I'll mirror you. 75.
Same. Joe, did you know that song?
I did not, no.
Okay.
I feel like the tune was somewhat recognizable of things I've heard before, but no, I did not know
I
that.
I think that it was like primed to be a big hit, and it just didn't happen. But that was only my interpretation, so I thought maybe if you had heard, but I think I'm right.
Maybe if Rihanna or somebody who we knew better had recorded that, maybe if there was...
Charlie XCX has been a pop songwriter for people like Rihanna. I don't know if Rihanna specifically, but she's written a lot of hit songs for other people. That was how she came up. And just in the past few years has been really building a fan base of her own. But still, just like right on the tipping point of superstardom. Never quite reaching over exactly, but beloved by many. And this is a great song. I would give it like a 90.
Okay, you gotta. Can you find 100 Gex, Griff?
Yeah, give me a sec.
Okay, go ahead and grab that because 100 Gex is, I don't know if that's a thing, a person, a group, but... Griffin played for us a couple weeks ago something that sounded like a children's cartoon had been auto-tuned and it was popular music. So I thought, all right, this is just Griff reaching too far for us. New York Times says it was the best album of the year because they want to make us crazy in the heartland. But I know other people who aren't Griffin or some highfalutin New York Times music critic, and they, when they hear this, they listen to it all the time. And I don't understand that either.
It's a movement.
Okay, so do you have anything
Gex Nation. For? No, I have to clean it up. I was playing...
Oh.
There are precious few of their songs that have clean lyrics, so you'll have to let me come back with it later in the show, I think.
All right, fair enough then. There's something else I want to do, too. We mentioned the John Mulaney special that dropped on Netflix. This is what Christopher Borelli said in the Chicago Tribune about John Mulaney's new Netflix special called Sack Lunch. The headline is, the best gift of the year. I watched it. Griffin watched it. Joe, I'll bet you haven't seen it yet. It just dropped. Have you taken time to watch the John Mulaney special?
I have not. Big fan of Mulaney, though.
Oh, my gosh.
John Mulaney and the Sack Lunch Bunch.
And the Sack Lunch Bunch. And he is from which? He's from Lincoln Park.
Yeah.
He's a Chicago guy.
Yep.
Which, I don't know, does he reference that? Does he talk about that a lot?
I was just thinking about this. In his very first album... probably from about 10 years ago, he tells a whole story about being at the Salt and Pepper Diner.
Oh, yes.
In Lincoln Park. And I was only, that's one of his most famous bits, but I was only thinking about that because that diner is still there. It's been out of business for as long as I've been visiting Chicago, but it's still standing with the sign.
Oh, really?
And there's just nothing has taken its place yet.
Well, didn't he do some shtick about Walter Jacobson, our very own Walter Jacobson?
He had a bit about Walter Jacobson. He did on his last special, he did the bit about J.J. Bittenbinder, the Chicago detective.
Yeah, right. Oh, gosh.
That did Street Smarts.
Very funny. Yeah. Okay, so here's what Christopher Borelli says in the Tribune today. He said, yesterday, wait, whoa. He talks about the best of 2019 lists. And he says the problem with this is that after arriving too late for the November deadlines of many journalists, but right on time emotionally, Netflix has dropped John Mulaney and the Sack Lunch Bunch, a children's variety show. And it's almost unsurprising that the Chicago comedian special arrived on Christmas Eve, because this year he's been the gift that keeps on giving. And then he talks about all of the stuff that Mulaney's done in the last year or so and how good a lot of it is. And still, John Mulaney and the Sack Lunch Bunch is his best present of the year and his warmest. Here's the inspiration, says Borelli. Low budget, high energy, children's public TV of the 1970s and 80s. Think Electric Company, Zoom, 3-2-1 Contact. These are the shows I grew up with, or I didn't grow up with, but were very much a part of the household noise of my youth and of my children's youth, even if we weren't regular watchers. I mean, when I saw this special, it looked so much like those shows. Electric Company, for instance, and I thought, so is he mocking them, or is this an homage to them? It's kind of somewhere in between. On a soundstage filled with kids wearing a white V-neck sweater that would not look out of place in his native Lincoln Park, he says he recently watched kids' TV and was not impressed. Also, he says he has no children and has no plans to have kids either. What follows is loving, but also decidedly uneven, Borelli says. Mulaney's a bad actor and a perfect comedian. So here's what it sounds like. The first one, Griff, will be the fun visual bit. He shows a tight shot of something, and then progressively they zoom out until you can guess what it is. So it's like a guessing game sort of for kids, and this is the way Mulaney imagines it.
Can you guess what we're looking at before we zoom out?
And it zooms out.
You see it every day.
Zooms out more.
Keep guessing.
Zoom out more.
It's the October 95 issue of People magazine featuring Larry Hagman's death scare.
Yeah! And then they go on to another skit. I mean, it's just like, okay, so there's 15 seconds, but it gives you a sense of how much that sounds like those shows, but also kind of how irreverent it is, right? Googie is a character on this fictitious show. So the John Mulaney special is a whole, like, hour-long kids special. It looks like Saturday morning TV or after-school TV when you were a kid.
With original songs.
Oh, my gosh. The singing and the songwriting on the show is terrific. I'll get to that in a second. Googie is a character on this fictitious show who looks like a giant purple Barney, and he runs around and does silly things, sometimes as a transition from one sketch to another. Here's a scene from the show.
Hey, kids, who's blue, furry, and 7 feet tall?
Googie! Go, Googie, go, Googie, go! Googie!
Googie went to the park yesterday, and he had a pretty Googie time. Let's take a look.
So now we see Googie running around in a park.
No, Googie, run further!
Runs out even further.
Hey, Googie, run near!
He does all kinds of crazy stunts.
Go, Googie, go!
I'm sorry that no one told you that Ronnie DiMaria, the guy who played Googie, died yesterday.
Wait, what?
He died doing what he loved. Dressing up in the Googie costume and running around to make people laugh.
He died during the shoot?
Those are supposed to be funny?
They're supposed to be fun. They're like energy. I don't know. They help with transitions in the show. And no, Aria, he didn't die during the shoot. He died well after he wrapped when he was already in his car.
Because he was running around in the costume?
No, the costume had nothing to do with it because he died so long after he wrapped shooting. Right, Tyler? You were there.
My call time was at 3, and he was dead at 3.
Look, listen. Ronnie had an enlarged heart. And isn't that kind of fitting? That he died because his heart was too big.
You knew about his medical condition?
Well, I seem to recall a group of kids yelling, "Run, Googie, run!"
That's
the other foot.
Those are recorded out of context.
Look.
So the kids are all sitting around, just kind of having a chat with our Mr. Rogers friend, and it goes off the rails. Everything kind of goes off the rails.
That's why I like John Mulaney, though. He does so much unique stuff like that.
Oh, my gosh. This show, in fact, here's one other thing I'll say about it. We'll take a break, and then I want to play for you a song from the show. But when you first see the kids introduce themselves, you go, oh, this is a bunch of precocious TV kid brats, and I'm not going to like them. And the kids are, they got one foot in that camp, but he's able to save them, and the kids are able to save themselves.
Yeah, other transitions, more heartfelt, are actual interviews with the kids that you can tell are unscripted and feel very real. And at the end of the show, it becomes very kind of emotional. It's beautiful.
Borelli writes about that, and I'll get to that in a second. Yeah, but I mean, the kids, like in the little cutaways where you might say, hey, kids, what's your favorite color? He goes, tell me about therapy. And then the kids talk about their sessions with their child psychologists, and it's real. And they say things about their moms that I don't know that their moms would love. So it's really unlike anything you've seen before. This Netflix John Mulaney special. One song from the special after this. On social media, I'm WGN King John. This morning we posted a fascinating video about the salaries that the top athletes in the world make over the last 30 years. There's a video that is just, I won't do it justice describing it, but if you like me on Facebook, you'll see something that you can't take your eyes off of, this visual graph, a moving graph that shows the salaries of some athletes. I'll leave it at that. But we were talking about athletes and their salaries. But right now, a little bit more about the John Mulaney special, which just dropped on Netflix. What's the name of the kids, Griffin?
John Mulaney and the Sack Lunch Bunch.
Somebody texted in about that?
Yeah, they said, so John, I'm confused. Is it really a children's special or is it a mock of a children's special?
That's a good question. How do you answer that?
It is both. It is for kids. It sort of spoofs. It's for kids and adults, I think. But you can definitely safely watch it with kids. Yeah. I think they take special care to push the kind of jokes they're telling, but it's never off color or something that would make you feel uncomfortable watching it with kids. But, and this is a cliche to say about children's entertainment, but I think this is what they're going for. It sort of lightly mocks the setup, but also deeply loves it. And hopefully it will be fun for kids and adults to watch. I mean, I'm an adult. I watched it alone and I thought it was good.
I've watched it twice. I think,
I didn't know you were so in love with this.
I'm a John Mulaney fan, and this isn't like anything you've seen before.
I'll just say before we get back in, it's exactly what he wanted to do with his sitcom on Fox, which no one remembers because
it wasn't any good.
It was not good, but he was trying to recreate multi-camera sitcoms from the 70s and 80s that he loved when he was a kid, And I think the idea was also to push them a little bit further into something weirder. But instead, he just completely recreated it, and it was totally unmemorable and lasted like 6 episodes.
Well, this is more ambitious than that.
I think this is what he kind of wanted that to be.
When I started watching this, I thought, you cannot make this work. I think it completely works. You may have to be a little patient to kind of catch the vibe. One quick question before we do play the song. Do you think this is a show for adults that kids can watch, or is this a show for kids that adults can enjoy? Bugs Bunny was that way once upon a time.
It really like goes back and forth, I think.
I think it's a show for adults that kids can enjoy.
Yeah, maybe.
But it works for everybody, although some of the jokes might be lost on the kids. So here we are sitting around talking about the favorite New York moments. Once again, John Mulaney and his V-neck sort of Mr. Rogers vibe. And the kids and John Mulaney are talking about famous people or bizarre things they've seen in the streets of New York. So the kids are saying things that are comical just because they're coming out of a child's mouth. They're not inappropriate, but they're just rather adult. One of the young kids describes seeing on the streets of New York a white lady crying. And John Mulaney says, well, in New York, that's not uncommon at all.
Well, there is one New York moment I'll never forget. I saw her too.
Oh, I doubt it was the same white lady. You know, once you keep your eyes peeled, you'll see crying white ladies all over New York City, often in expensive workout gear or hospital scrubs.
It was 2 years ago, Christmas time, foot of snow, passing through Union Square, and I saw this crying white lady just kinda standing there.
instead of getting on the subway with my entire class for a field trip to look at bugs, I'd walked over. I approach. She's demure. She thinks, who is this 4-foot bachelor? So my hand I extend and say, I'm Alex J, and you look like you need a friend. Why are you crying in a public place? Perhaps a friend of yours was fake to your face. Or did you just call? In her purse.
It goes on for 3.5 minutes.
Of course,
with choreography that would make Fred Astaire proud. A light on a street corner. The woman dances in and out of the pool of light. The little kid approaches. They dance. They go to a cafe. They have some laughs. She drinks a martini. He makes her happy again. Totally. Totally crazy. The kids can sing, and I think John Mulaney wrote the songs in the show as well as the shtick.
The lyrics. The music was by someone else.
Yeah. So anyway, that's just a...
And he had a co-writer.
A little review of that. Christopher Brelli wrote about it in the Chicago Tribune, and I agreed with what he said. Brelli concluded his review this way. It ends with the Sack Lunch Bunch saying that they fear the loss of their parents' love, and the loss of their parents, and the loss of goodness in the world. And as each says this in his or her own way, the effect is touching. You are the gift you give others, Mulaney is saying, so remember that. Be confident. Use your voice and own it. Maybe at the same time that the guy that wrote a lot of the lines and storylines you know from Charlie Brown has passed away. It's almost appropriate that these two things intersect in the same week, because this is kids as adults saying things that everybody can appreciate. And that is the John Mulaney special. How about that, huh? It's 11:53 on WGN. Griff, we sort of departed from the Vibe Score segment.
You got carried away. It's okay. I'm thrilled that you responded to that special in this way. It's a weird thing, and you don't know how people will react to it. So I give it.
I think people will watch it and not like it. I'm giving it a 95. Joe, give it a 95.
Okay, I'll give it a 95.
Hey, James, in the newsroom, I don't know if you're tuned in, but just say 95.
95.
Attaboy, James.
Don't really like it.
You didn't see it, have you, James Sears?
Not seen what?
Yeah, exactly. By the way, so as we wrap
now
up...
Now you're on the record. You don't want that. You don't know what it was.
As we do the News Click segment, our Vibe Score segment, rather, we just got a couple of minutes here. 2 minutes, Griff? Okay, and then we'll wrap this up. I think we should just vibe on the number of bowl games that are out there. And do we like having, 45 college football games between Christmas and the second week of January or not?
I think it goes a little bit before Christmas, too. I mean, some of the bowls started on the 20th, 21st. What I like is when you have a day full of bowl games. And I feel like, okay, you're probably not a fan of how many bowl games there are nowadays, but there's no way those are going to diminish. But I feel like people might be a little bit more interested if you can just restructure the way it all is. And in order for this to happen, you'd probably have to stretch out the season another week, which wouldn't be the most fantastic thing.
You want brackets? You want like a 16-team tournament?
Yeah. I mean, I would love to expand the playoffs to 8 teams, but that's very difficult to do. You're asking for a lot from these college athletes to put another whole week on their schedule, or rather another 2 weeks. But I like today. There's a handful of games, and you can just basically...
But the games today matter, too.
Correct. Yeah, with... As the year progresses, the severity of the bowl games increase. But that's what I like, is once one bowl game ends, another one comes on. It's like college football March Madness style.
All right, but last night, Joe, I watched the Iowa game against USC.
Mm-hmm.
First half was entertaining. I don't know a lick about either of those clubs. I enjoyed watching. It was something to watch. Air Force, I think, played last night. Was that the other game?
Yeah, they beat Washington State.
And I just like having football on. So I'm not real exercised by the ridiculous names of the bowls or the meaninglessness of them. Some teams that aren't 500 are in bowls.
And
right?
I think that's what people get offended by. I mean,
right.
Eastern Michigan fell to 6-7 losing their bowl game this year.
Well, because we can wrap in just a sec, but... You're saying, I don't care have as many bowl games as you want. But that's the problem. There's so many bowl games that you don't care. Not and
true.
It's kind of like you might care more if there,
if there was only the Rose Bowl, the Peach Bowl.
Yeah.
But when it all comes, I mean, but those bowl games are still there. I don't think it takes away the significance of the important bowl games because people are still just going to wait for those games to come. And yeah, again, they're still there. Those
times
won't go
up,
away.
All these bowl games, 1 to 100, I'm giving them a 92. I enjoy the background. Joe says
88.
Griffin says
60.
We are out of time. It's 11:56. This is WGN.